From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
A recent report at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting reveals extensive political meddling by the board and members of the executive staff there. But what it doesn't reveal is the extent to which the White House had a hand in programming decisions on PBS, NPR, and other public media.
An internal investigation finds former CPB head Kenneth Tomlinson in violation of the CPB's code of ethics. We'll speak with Tim Carr of Free Press. Then the latest in Gaza, splits in Israel's Labor Party, and the wall. And from the Israeli occupation of Palestine to Jordan to Iraq, it's hard to find humor in the Middle East, but a group of Arab American comics are playing to sold-out crowds here in New York City.
Iran officially in the axis of evil. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We officially have a membership card. That's right. Axis of evil. Thank you very much. Coming through. Thank you.
And we'll take a look at the third annual New York Arab American Comedy Festival. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After initial denials, the Pentagon's now admitting it used white phosphorus as an offensive weapon in the attack on Fallujah last November. This is Pentagon spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Barry Venable, interviewed on the BBC.
Can you confirm then that it was used as an offensive weapon against enemy troops during the siege of Fallujah?
Yes. It was used as an incendiary weapon against enemy combatants.
Lieutenant Colonel Venable's statement is in direct contradiction to what Pentagon spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Steve Boylan told Democracy Now! Last week.
I know of no cases where people were deliberately targeted by the use of white phosphorus.
Lieutenant Colonel Boylan was denying accusations first made in a documentary produced by the Italian state television network RAI. The Pentagon now says it used the weapon against insurgents, not civilians. White phosphorus produces a dense white smoke that can cause serious burns to human flesh. The RAI documentary showed graphic footage of civilians with severe wounds and burns allegedly caused by phosphorus bombing. The Iraqi government says 173 tortured, malnourished detainees have been found in a raid on an Interior Ministry compound. U.S. forces carried out the raid Sunday. The detainees were found in a locked basement. In an interview with CNN, Iraq's Undersecretary for Interior Security said, quote, "I saw signs of physical abuse by brutal beating. One or two detainees were paralyzed and some had skin peeling off various parts of their bodies." Mohsen Abdelhamid, leader of the Iraqi Islamic Party, the country's largest Sunni political group, told the Associated Press he'd warned top government officials about torture at Interior Ministry detention centers, including the one raided Sunday. He says his complaints were dismissed. The Iraqi government says it'll launch an investigation into the incident. The human rights group Amnesty International welcomed the decision, but said the investigation should extend to cover all detention facilities in Iraq. Also in Iraq, the Pentagon says it killed over 80 insurgents in a 48-hour period of fighting in the Syrian border town of Obaidi. Military officials say six U.S. soldiers were killed during the same period. Jordan's introduced strict new security measures in the wake of last week's hotel bombings in Amman. Under the new rules, Jordanians must provide authorities with the names, nationalities, and passport details of any foreigners renting property. The Jordanian government's also drafting new legislation that would allow security forces to detain suspects indefinitely. Meanwhile, 11 top officials, including the country's chief of security, submitted their resignations on Tuesday. On Capitol Hill, the Republican-controlled Senate passed a resolution mandating the White House provide quarterly Iraq progress reports, urging it to accelerate the process for withdrawal of U.S. troops. The measure passed after a Democratic measure calling for a specific timetable for troop withdrawal was defeated. Commenting on the rejected Democratic resolution, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, quote, "I think it speaks to a bit of nervousness about public perception of how the war is going in terms of 2006 elections. And to be honest with you, the war is going to be going on long after 06. I'm more worried about getting it right in Iraq than the 06 elections," he said. The Senate also approved what lawmakers hailed as a bipartisan compromise on legal rights for Guantanamo Bay detainees. A Senate vote last week stripped detainees of their right to challenge their detentions in U.S. courts. A Democratic proposal to restore the right to habeas corpus failed Tuesday. Under the new measure, detainees will only be allowed to challenge their status as, quote, enemy combatants and only appeal sentences only exceeding 10 years. In a rare statement, a group of Guantanamo lawyers with the Center for Constitutional Rights called the new measure a scandal. The statement said, quote, the great writ of habeas corpus is as old as the Magna Carta. It's too fundamental, too important, too precious to be rewritten on the back of an envelope, then passed as a floor amendment to an authorization bill on 4 days' notice, and then hastily further revised, it said. In Israel, a military court has acquitted an army captain who fired 17 bullets into a Palestinian schoolgirl. 13-year-old Iman Alhams was killed while walking by an Israeli army tower near the Rafah refugee camp in Gaza last year. An audio tape of the incident shows the girl identified as a little girl who looked scared to death. Soldiers fired anyway, hitting her several times, including as she tried to flee. On the tape, the captain, identified to the media only as Captain R, said he was going to, quote, confirm the kill. Palestinian witnesses say they then saw him shoot Iman twice in the head and several times in her body. On the recording, the captain explained, quote, anything that's mobile that moves in the security zone, even if it's a three-year-old, needs to be killed, unquote. After the verdict, the girl's father, Samir Alhams, said, quote, they did not charge him with Iman's murder, only with small offenses, and now they say he's innocent of those, even though he shot my daughter so many times. This was the cold-blooded murder of a girl. The soldier murdered her once, and the court has murdered her again. What's the message? They're telling their soldiers to kill Palestinian children, the grieving father said. Longtime Washington Post journalist and current assistant editor Bob Woodward testified Monday that a senior administration official told him about CIA operative Valerie Plame nearly a month before her identity was thought to be first disclosed. The official appears to be someone other than Louis Libby or Karl Rove. Woodward was questioned by Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald after the unnamed official alerted Fitzgerald of his conversation with Woodward. Citing a confidentiality agreement, Woodward and Post editors did not reveal the source's identity. Post editors say Woodward only told them of the conversation last month. The Federal Emergency Management Agency announced Tuesday it'll stop subsidizing hotel stays for an estimated 150,000 Hurricane Katrina evacuees. The decision will go into effect December 1st, giving evacuees 15 days to find a new place to live. Some families will be eligible for an additional 3 months' rental assistance, while evacuees in Louisiana and Mississippi may have their subsidies extended on a two-week basis up until the first week of January. Housing advocates criticize the decision. Sheila Crowley, president of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, said, quote, unless they have some serious plan for helping move people from hotels into apartments other than putting up flyers, as of December 1st, there's going to be a lot of homeless people, she said. A White House document obtained by the Washington Post shows executives from big oil companies met with Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force in 2001. The documents appear to prove a suspicion long held by environmentalists and contradicts testimony oil executives gave before Congress last week. The document shows representatives from ExxonMobil, Conoco, Shell Oil, and BP America met with Cheney aides responsible for developing a national energy policy. Some of their task force's recommendations have become law, while others have been held up in Congress. In testimony before the Senate Energy and Commerce Committees last week, chief executives from ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips denied their companies took part in the Energy Task Force discussions. The White House has refused to release records of the meeting's participants. A spokesperson for Vice President Cheney declined comment on the White House document. The executives were not sworn in for their testimony, and so they cannot face perjury charges. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey said he'll ask the Justice Department to investigate. Lautenberg told the Post, quote, the White House went to great lengths to keep these meetings secret, and now oil executives may be lying to Congress about their role in the Cheney task force. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The results of a six-month internal investigation of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting were made public yesterday. The investigation, conducted by the corporation's Inspector General, Kenneth Kanz, exposes extensive wrongdoing and political interference by the CPB's former chair, Kenneth Tomlinson. Tomlinson, a staunch conservative, head of CPB until stepping down until last September, he resigned from the corporation's board on November 3rd after Kanz's findings were presented to the board in a three-day closed meeting held at an undisclosed location in Washington, D.C. The Inspector General's report found Tomlinson repeatedly violated the CPB's contracting rules and code of ethics in order to promote conservatives in the organization. It documented numerous occasions in which Tomlinson ignored CPB procedures in trying to hire his own handpicked candidates to monitor programs that he accused of liberal bias. Earlier this year, it was revealed Tomlinson hired a Republican operative to monitor the political leanings of shows hosted by Bill Moyers, Tavis Smiley, and Diane Rehm. The report also found Tomlinson had inappropriate involvement in the development of the Journal Editorial Report. That's the conservative public affairs magazine program of the Wall Street Journal that began airing on PBS last year. The investigation also uncovered numerous emails between Tomlinson and White House staff about the hiring of Patricia Harrison, a former Republican Party chair, as the new president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The report states, quote, while cryptic in nature, their timing and subject matter gives the appearance that the former chair was strongly motivated by political considerations in filing the president's CEO position and filling that position. Tomlinson released a statement yesterday calling the report's charges malicious and inappropriate. Despite all this, Tomlinson remains the chair of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, a federal agency that oversees the U.S. government's international broadcasting services, including Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and the Arabic-language satellite TV station Al Hura. Last July, the State Department opened an inquiry into Tomlinson's work at that agency. It's looking into accusations that Tomlinson misused funds and hired unqualified employees. In the course of that inquiry, the State Department investigators uncovered email traffic between Deputy White House Chief of Staff Karl Rove and Tomlinson and turned it over to the CPB investigators, though it was not included in yesterday's report. Here to talk about all of these developments is Tim Carr, Campaign Director for Free Press. We contacted CPB repeatedly, but they declined our offer to be on the program. Welcome to Democracy
Thanks
Now.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Well, why don't you just go through the findings of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Office of Inspector General report that has just come out.
Well, it's a 67-page report that details a lot of Kenneth Tomlinson's wrongdoings within the organization. And it gives a fairly extensive case, an indictment of Kenneth Tomlinson, but what it doesn't do is reveal complicity by other CPB board members as well as CPB staff members. It's Tomlinson is not alone at the CPB. There, the new chair, the person who replaced him, Cheryl Halpern, the vice chair, Gayheart Gaines, are Republican Party operatives who were chosen for these positions not based on their experience in public broadcasting, but on their loyalty to the White House. So while the report does reveal a lot, it doesn't let us know a lot of things as well. And another thing that it doesn't reveal, again, is the complicity of the White House. Those emails that you discussed allegedly between Karl Rove and Tomlinson and between other unidentified White House officials are not a part of this report. We know that there is another report that was submitted to the CPB that the CPB has in their hands that has not been made public.
A report by who?
A report by Inspector General Kanz. This 67.
Two different ones.
There is a separate report that has evidence, including these emails and the extent to which the White House. I mean, the emails themselves could let us know the extent to which the White House had a hand in influencing public broadcasting program. These are still under lock and key.
Now, tell us what's wrong with this. Okay, you have Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, and back and forth emails with the chair of the CPB, Kenneth Tomlinson.
Well, I mean, this is just indicative of a larger scheme, and we have a White House that seems to be waging war against the freedom of the press. Throughout 2005, we've had incidents of bribing journalists like Armstrong Williams. They have gone after dissenting views in the media, labeling them as, quote, liberal advocacy journalism, unquote. And what you see here is a pattern of deception to dismantle the Fourth Estate, and in doing so, disengage the American population from the political process. Kenneth Tomlinson's work within the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is just a part of a larger scheme, and we need to know more. We need to know what these emails contained and the extent of White House involvement in public broadcasting.
Can you talk about what the Inspector General found, about the code of ethics, about who was hired, about the monitoring of the political content of programs?
He went well beyond the realm of the CPB mandate, which is to act as a heat shield between public broadcasting and politicians, to one, you know, promote the inclusion of the Wall Street Journal's editorial report, to seek funding for that, to promote the hiring of Patricia Harrison, the former RNC chairman, and push an agenda beyond the realms of his mandate. And so the report gives a fairly detailed account of that. It does also include a lot of traffic between Tomlinson and his fellow board members, which would imply that it goes beyond Kenneth Tomlinson alone. The other board members need to be made accountable.
Now, wasn't there a claim that when he hired this political consultant, and was at Indianapolis to the political monitoring of the programs,
yes,
that the others didn't know about
this?
That's
right. Frederick Mann, who's a political consultant from Indiana, was hired to monitor Bill Moyer's program now, and in addition to some others for liberal content. This was done beyond the accountability of the rest of the board. The report itself, which has been made available at Free Press and other websites, is fairly ludicrous. It becomes clear that this consultant was not truly an expert media analyst, but someone who was chosen based on his political credentials.
Which were
pretty limited, to be frank. He was part of an organization based in Washington that trains journalists to represent conservative viewpoints in the media.
Does this go to criminal wrongdoing?
Well, it is a violation of federal statute. The report found that Tomlinson indeed violated the Public Broadcasting Act, but there is no avenue, and they don't recommend any avenue for punishment. So it is a violation of law, but it is not something that, as far as we know, will go to further investigation. We would like to see the Congress get further involved. We would like to see the content of these emails, and even a GAO investigation might be a good move to reveal further evidence. And this is just the beginning of a process of revealing the extent to which politics has influenced public broadcasting.
Tomlinson is no longer chair of CPB.
Right.
And then as a result of this report, he stepped down even as a board member of CPB.
That's right.
But he is still chair of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Explain what this is.
The Broadcasting Board of Governors is an organization under the State Department that oversees programming on Voice of America, Al Hurra, Radio Free Europe, and other official news organs. He's involved with the board there. There's an investigation going on there as well regarding the alleged misuse of funds by Tomlinson. So this is really, the Broadcasting Board of Governors is really a propaganda wing of the State Department. So you have...
Well, for example, Voice America can't be broadcast in this country. It's against the law, right? Because
that's right.
It is propaganda that is supposed to go overseas, but not here.
That's right. And Al Hurra, which is the satellite, Arabic language satellite network, is also under this program, and that was designed to present the American view to Arabic speaking.
And didn't
viewers.
The head of Al Hurra just quit?
There was a congressional hearing last week, in which he was grilled. There is a lot of concern about the misuse of $49 million, which is taxpayer money, that budgeted Al Hurra, and that this has gone to, it hasn't been accounted for fully. So again, this is, you know, you have Tomlinson linked to this larger effort to spread American propaganda, not only through official organs like Al Haraa, but to try to infiltrate public broadcasting and have it express a viewpoint more compliant with the White House.
Well, when you have the chair, the same man for both agencies,
yeah.
Isn't that already set up to cross the line? And why is that? Why would you have Tomlinson, the head of both the governing, the title of the broadcast
right.
board of governors and the CPB?
I don't know why. It suggests vast conflicts of interest. You also have, but it doesn't end with Tomlinson. Patricia Harrison, who is the new president of the CPB, also was she was formerly undersecretary at the State Department for Public Affairs and Public Policy. This is the organization that crafts America's message to the world. So you have public broadcasting, an attempt to fold public broadcasting under the State Department, under these organs, which were set up to represent an official view and not the sort of contrarian adversarial journalism that we come to expect.
And what about the ombudsman in the White House that was brought in?
Yes, this was brought in through consulting with a White House communications officer. The report itself found that raised some questions about that, but didn't think that was the heart of the problem. But it does indicate a pattern of reliance upon the White House to set the agenda within the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
What's the original mandate of the CPB?
The original mandate is to act as a quote-unquote heat shield, to insulate public broadcasting from the hot winds of Washington, D.C. But the problem is that you have board members who are all political appointees. So at the moment, it's a 9-member board. There are only 7 sitting members right now. But there's a majority of Republicans there who are setting the agenda. And these are people with not vast experience in public broadcasting. They are fundraisers for the GOP. It is a holding tank for people who've done well for the party, for people who aren't quite so qualified to be ambassadors. They often get appointed to the CPB board. So Free Press is very involved with new legislation, to promoting new legislation to create sweeping reforms across the corporation. So this structure no longer exists.
And so what would happen? How would people be chosen to be on the board?
One proposal that we support is to have 13 board members, 8 of whom are White House presidential appointees, but you can only allow the president to appoint 4 from each party, so there's no clear majority. We also need broader public representation from the stations, from the public interest community, so that you have a board that's looking after the public interest and not the interest of the White House.
Were you surprised by anything in this report?
No, we had pretty much expected this. There had been reporting within the New York Times and with other publications the extent of Tomlinson's meddling. And so we knew this. We knew what the report would say for the most part. What we want, but we still need to know the extent to which the White House is involved.
And the other report that hasn't been made public?
That is something that is sitting somewhere at CPB. We need to pressure Congress. We need to pressure Inspector General Kuntz to reveal all of the information. We need to look at this traffic between the White House and the CPB, and we need to truly inoculate public broadcasting from this sort of political influence.
Tim Carr, thanks for being
with
us. Free Press is the organization he represents. Tim Carr runs a blog at mediacitizen.blogspot.com. We'll have the information at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations. And we are broadcasting on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, and 9410 Link TV. On DirecTV, we broadcast at 375 Link TV, and we video and audio podcast at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, Israel agreed to allow Palestinians to reopen the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. And for the first time, Palestinians will be put in charge of operating the border. In addition, Palestinians will be allowed to build a seaport off the coast of Gaza and to improve transportation links between Gaza and the West Bank. In return, Israel will be given the ability to monitor the Gaza-Egypt border crossing through remote video cameras. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been credited with playing a key role in the agreement, which came just a day after Middle East envoy James Wolfensohn, the former president of the World Bank, warned Gaza was turning into a, quote, giant prison. The border agreement is just one of a series of major developments in the region in recent days. On Monday, an Israeli army captain was acquitted in the shooting death of a 13-year-old Palestinian girl. The shooting took place a year ago, October, as the girl walked near an Israeli army post on her way to school. Israeli troops claim they suspected she was carrying a bomb in her school bag. No explosives were found on her, but she wasn't searched until she was shot 17 times and killed. The shooting made international headlines after Israeli TV broadcast a recording of the Israeli army captain saying, quote, anything that's mobile that moves in the security zone, even if it's a three-year-old, needs to be killed. The family of the dead Palestinian girl protested the captain's acquittal. Her father, Samin al-Hams, said, quote, this was the cold-blooded murder of a girl. The soldier murdered her once, and the court has murdered her again. What's the message? They're telling their soldiers to kill Palestinian children, he said. In other news from the region, the Israeli political scene was dealt a shakeup last Thursday when union leader Amir Peretz defeated veteran statesman Shimon Peres for leadership of Israel's Labor Party. Peretz immediately announced Labor would leave the governing coalition, setting the stage for new elections within months. Meanwhile, Israelis and Palestinians spent the weekend marking two significant anniversaries. On Saturday, tens of thousands of Israelis gathered to mark the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was killed 10 years ago by a right-wing Jewish activist. Former President Clinton and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton attended the memorial for Rabin. Senator Clinton spent 3 days in Israel, but came under criticism for not visiting Gaza or the West Bank or meeting with Palestinians. During her trip, Clinton expressed her support for Israel to continue building the 400-mile wall through the West Bank. And on Friday, Palestinians mark the first anniversary of the death of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. To talk about all of these developments, we are joined by three guests in our Firehouse studios. Palestinian activist Ayad Morar is from the West Bank village of Bujus, where he organized the first popular committee against the wall in 2003. We're joined by Israeli activist Jonathan Pollack, who helped form the popular committee against the war. He's participated in more than 200 Palestinian organized demonstrations in the West Bank and has been arrested dozens of times. We're also joined by Lily Rivlin. She's a Jerusalem-born filmmaker and writer and co-chair of Meretz USA, the American affiliate of the Israeli political party Meretz. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let me start off with Lily Rivlin, the issue of the split in the Labor Party.
Well, I'm from Meretz, so I don't really go into that. But basically, the Labor Party has been divided into left wing and right wing. If I'm making it really simplistic, but the left wing won here, and it's a very important opportunity. I'm looking at this as a seismic kind of event. It could change the whole setup in the Israeli political scene, but it's too early to say, so I won't go further than that. But the basic differences now is that Amir Peretz came in, and he stands for a two-state solution and for domestic reform, meaning he'll pay attention to poverty issues. So that's important.
And is he a clear difference from Shimon Peres, do you think?
Big difference. I mean, everybody has been commenting on that. It could shift the whole Israeli political situation and clarify. It could make it, I dare not say this, a two-party system, but because it's far from that, but it could make the options for a voter clearer.
Jonathan Pollack, do you agree?
Well, I think that Amir Peretz definitely have different rhetorics, but it should be clear that the Israeli left had been using rhetorics with complete, with absolutely no connection to their practices on the ground, and I have no hope that this will actually change the political situation in Israel. People should remember that the left was in control in 48 with the expulsions. It was in control in 67 when Israel occupied the occupied territories. It was in control when the settlement project, the illegal settlement project in the West Bank began in the 70s. The left, the Zionist left, is the one that took the so-called peace process in Oslo and used it to cantonize the occupied territories and to maintain control over Palestinians using less military might, but just as much control. And this is what we see from the Zionist left throughout history. And I don't see any reason why Amir Peretz would be different. And his rhetoric is still racist. It's maybe more progressive, but it is still racist. So I don't see a big change. It may affect the Israeli political map, but that doesn't mean there'll be real change on the ground. There's a very strong consolidation of Israeli politics around the center, and Amir Peretz isn't a variation to that.
Lily Rivlin.
Thank you for. I think this, what you see right here is what is the problem of the left in Israel and everywhere else. I mean the disagreements between the two of us will get us nowhere. That this young man, Jonathan, is. I'd like to hear from Jonathan what his solution is, because it sounds to me like his solution would be a one state. Is that your position? It feels like it. And before, I mean, I'd like to hear you, but I see this as a no-win position. Jonathan's position is a no-win position. Our position, Meretz, and maybe hopefully Labor, will be a position that finally maybe we can move further. I'd like to hear what the Palestinian point of view is, but it gives us some hope. Jonathan's position, where are you going to go from here?
Well, my position, if I may say what my position is, is that the responsibility is on Israel. Israel is the occupying side. I'm not a politician. I don't speak of one state or two states. First of all, the occupation has to end. And this should be the outline of every plan. And Israel has to recognize its history and its responsibility as a colonizer in the Middle East. And all we do now is talking about what are Palestinians willing to do, about Hamas's charter, about the PLO's charter, etc., etc. But the side that is occupying the other side right now, the side that isn't recognizing the other side, is Israel, including the Zionist left. Throughout, the Zionist left had maintained control over Palestinian civilians and over the occupied territories in a variety of ways.
Jonathan,
some of them the so-called peace process.
I'd also like to ask Ayad Marar how you view this split. Does it matter to you at all in the Israeli Labor Party as a Palestinian?
I think that all the Palestinians looking forward, degrading to achieve their freedom and their peace. And we used to see the Labour's and the Likud exchanging political issue inside Israel, and both of them were occupied the Palestinian people. We saw Labour's in the government, and we saw Likud, and both of them have occupation upon our people. I think that no one worse than Sharon, And maybe now we have big opportunity or a bigger opportunity to achieve peace and freedom through this new leader. But I think that to be inside the government is something, and to be outside is another thing.
What about the recent developments of Gaza and the port and the opening to Egypt, the first time Israel's not controlling this?
Till now, the situation in Gaza is seemed like Gaza is a big jail for the Palestinian people, and it's a good step forward, but I still wondering why to wait 40 years to withdraw from Gaza and another 40 or 50 years to withdraw from West Bank. Why not to reduce the number of the killed people from both sides? Because the freedom and the peace must be in this land without no hope. Nothing will exist forever. So we have to reduce the time, to reduce the suffering from both people.
You and Jonathan Pollack are traveling around the country. You've just finished your tour against the wall. Jonathan Pollack is with the Popular Committee Against the Wall, Ayad Marar, the same organization. You've been engaged in direct action. What exactly have you been doing? How do you deal with the wall, Jonathan?
Just a correction. The Popular Committee Against the Wall is a Palestinian organization. I'm not part of it. But the way we try and deal with the wall is exactly by, as you described, by the form of direct action. The wall is immoral. It hurts the Palestinian civilians in a way that is unacceptable and even at times indescribable. And our way to deal with it is in a form of resistance. We do not ask anyone to stop the constructions, because no one has the right to engage this construction. We simply go and try and stop the work where it is being constructed.
Who's we and what do you do?
Oh, we as Israelis, Palestinians, and international activists. And what we do is, with nothing but our bodies, with our bare hands, normal people, mostly Palestinian farmers, go down to the lands where the bulldozers are working. 80% of the barrier is built on Palestinian land. And we try and stop the bulldozers. And we are met, we are all civilians, all these demonstrations are completely unarmed, and we are met with military repression. When all we are trying to do is stop the bulldozers from doing something that is immoral and had been declared illegal by the International Court of Justice. Where the wall is built, many times we try and dismantle it.
And you took the wall down in your community, Ayad Marar?
Yes.
You took it down.
We in the first time we succeed to move the wall close to the green line. We saved 1,200 dunams, which is equal to 300 acres planted with 3,000 olive trees in our village through our peaceful activities against the wall. It's a good step forward, a little bit successful, but I think that it's it can be a good example to choose the non-violence strategy to resist the occupation and to resist the wall, especially. In Budrus, the children, the women, the old people were struggling honestly, bravely, non-violently in order to stop the bulldozers who try to stop our children's food.
I wanted to ask Lily Rivlin, as an Israeli activist here, Israeli-born but working here, your response to Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton clearly setting up for a presidential run, going to Israel, not meeting with Palestinians. Interestingly, Condoleezza Rice did, the Secretary of State, at the same time. And then expressing support for the wall.
Well, first of all, I'm Palestinian-born. That makes a difference to establish that. I was born before the State of Israel, and there were other Jews who were born before the State of Israel. But to address your question, Meretz itself, the party, is split. There are people within the party who are for the wall, because what was the reason for the wall coming up. It was a response to the suicide bombers. I myself am against the wall, but as an individual. But there are many people in the party who think that you had to have a separation. Now, there may be a separation because that's self-defense. A country has the right to defend itself. But I do agree with Ayad and Jonathan. It went beyond the green line. It was a way, in many places, they took Palestinian territory. So I'm against that. Now, the fact that Hillary Clinton took that position, that's a political position. She's going to, hopefully, I say hopefully because I have mixed feelings on this too, she's going to run for president of the United States. Mixed feelings because she's a woman. I'm a feminist. I like seeing a woman in that position. Mixed feelings because she has to, she has some policies I don't necessarily support. But I understand why she took that position.
Why?
Because she's going to run for president of the United States, and she thinks that's going to get her votes.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up, and I want to thank you all for being here. Ayad Mahrar with the Popular Committee Against the Wall, Palestinian activist. Jonathan Pollack, Israeli activist. The two have been traveling the country speaking out against the wall. And Lily Rivlin, born in Jerusalem, filmmaker and writer here, co-chair of the Meretz USA Party. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, from the wall to the bombings in Jordan to the war in Iraq. It is hard to find much humor in the Middle East, but a group of Arab American comics is doing just that and playing to sold-out crowds here in New York City.
How many non-Arabs are in here? Non-Arab, non-Muslims, non-Arabs? Is that right? Welcome to our meeting. This is nice. Because you saw the cops outside and shit. They're like, we can't trust them. There's 1,400 Arabs and Muslims in there. Something's going down.
My name is Maysoon Zayed, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself so that you get the rest of this routine. I am a Palestinian Muslim virgin with cerebral palsy from New Jersey. I'm 30, which in America is like, you're okay, it's okay that you're single and 30, seriously. But in Arab years, I'm 67.
Iranians, man, we are officially. You mean, you guys Arabs, you guys are part of it, but we got named. We're, I mean, Iraq too, but Iran officially in the axis of evil. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We officially have a membership card, that's right. Axis of Evil, thank you very much, coming through, thank you. Now I go to clubs, Axis of Evil, yes, yes. North Korea with me, let's go, come on, let's go. No, at least they were breaking stereotypes in commercials. Middle Easterners aren't breaking stereotypes, not in commercials. You'd never turn on the TV and see like a United Airlines commercial with a Middle Eastern pilot. Right, you never see me stand there going like this, come fly the friendly skies. I dare you.
Peace out, everybody. One love.
Some of the comedians performing at the third annual New York Arab American Comedy Festival opened on Sunday in Manhattan, going through Thursday, showcasing the talents of Arab American actors, comics, playwrights, and filmmakers. Co-founded by Dean Obidallah, a former attorney turned stand-up comic, joins us in our studio along with Henda Yoob, a Palestinian actress who's starring in Private that has just been released. She's making her debut at the film at the Comedy Festival this year. They joined us in our studio late yesterday, and I began by asking Dean, in these dire times in the Middle East, how he manages to be funny.
You try to use your sense of humor to deal with the topics of the day. I mean, it's a hard life for anybody with an Arab-American heritage or looks Arab-American or a Muslim last name. So you try to deal with it by trying to make people laugh and a release of tension. And so you tackle the big issues. That's what we're doing this in this New York Arab American Comedy Festival, dealing with issues like racial profiling, even Palestine, Arab dating, President Bush, all through comedy. Because you can rant and rave all anytime you want, but if you make people laugh, you hope you're entertaining them and making some political points at the same time.
Dean, what is your funniest routine?
Well, I'll tell you, my jokes about President Bush tend to do well. I performed in Beirut, Dubai, Haifa, and in Ramallah, and my jokes about President Bush have always done well. He's united the world in laughter, I think. And it's just the littlest things he does. Like, recently, and I should preface this by saying the word judiciary is a difficult word to pronounce. And I swear, he went on, he goes, we got to get better people in the court system. I mean, that's what happened. And look at his approval. Now, America's finally waking up. It's down to 36% approval rating in America. Statistically, herpes has a higher approval rating right now than President Bush. E. coli is gaining on our president.
Is there a different response between people here and people in other parts of the world, in the Arab world?
I'll tell you. I mean, part of it is that they can laugh at things they know about. Everyone knows President Bush because the leader of the free world, in quotes, is there. And they know about him. They watch him on TV. So when you do jokes about him, they'll laugh just the same. They love laughing at him. Before the election, I had people in America would argue with me, people, red staters or supporters of Bush. But now, you don't even have many people defending him in the audiences. I've noticed the change in audiences, the willingness to laugh at him. And it just shows a lack of support now among the average person. No one feels the need to defend him any longer.
How do you joke about Iraq?
Well, you don't joke about Iraq as much as I'll talk about the elections, you know, the running for office again in December, and how courageous it must be to be a candidate, because it must make you a target. So I'm wondering if the campaign commercials turn on TV, it's like, hello, my name is Walid. I'm running for president of Iraq, and just want to say this to my fellow Iraqis, please do not vote for me. I don't want to die. Do you know who you should vote for? Samir. He is a much better candidate than I am. So you try to use humor to emphasize the point that obviously to run for office in Iraq in today's world, it's got to be a very courageous act because your life is on the line. The lawyers in the trial with Saddam Hussein, they lost their lives. So you try to deal with that, like the Patriot Act, about the ability to find out any book we take out in the library. You could talk about that seriously all day, but we try to make light of it and say, well, honestly, do you think the guys in Al-Qaeda are that short on money? They're going to public libraries? Are they sitting around going, okay, we need a book, but we're like $20 short. Omar, go to the library and try not to look suspicious. And are there books out there that give them away, like I'm Al-Qaeda, you're Al-Qaeda, or Chicken Soup for the Terrorist Soul? No, clearly the government wants to know what we're reading, and that's a very scary time. This war on terrorism has become a war on freedom of thought. And so you try to make jokes about it so people can laugh, and hopefully they talk about it afterwards.
What's most surprising is perhaps not you as an Arab American being funny, but you as a lawyer being funny.
Well, I think I've turned in my lawyer shield. It's been several years now since I've really practiced law. I'm much happier and a better human being for it on every level. So I'm much happier as a comedian.
Palestine. You can joke about that.
You do. I mean, you don't joke about suicide bombers, of course. I mean, my father's from Palestine. But you talk about, like, well, I went to Palestine, I did a show in Ramallah, and a true story, we were at the airport, and this shows, I think, the sense of humor of Palestinians. We're at the airport, and we're cordoned off because of our race. I'm Palestinian-American, yet I go on the line with the Arabs. That's what they put me on. And there's a Palestinian man in front of me. We're surrounded by Israeli security, and the Palestinian man goes, hey, can you watch my luggage? I have to go to the bathroom. And I said, do you think they really steal your luggage? And he looks at me and goes, they stole my land. You know, and he was being funny. And I love the sense of humor and the resilience of the Palestinian people shown just from living and under occupation and still being able to laugh and joke around is great.
We're talking to Dean Obadella, who is one of the founders of the New York Arab American Comedy Festival. We're also joined by Hend Ayoub, who is a Palestinian actor who is in the festival, but also is one of the stars of a new film that has just been released. Can you talk about Private? What's it about?
Well, first of all, it's based on a true story that really happened. It's about a Palestinian family's home being occupied by the Israeli army.
Where?
The house itself is in Gaza. But this is not an only one story. It happens in every house that is located between Palestinian villages and Israeli settlement. So any house that is in between, the Israelis find that it's a good viewing point. So they just take over the house. And the only reason I think that this movie, story reached media is because the family refused to leave the house. What happens in most cases is that the family just leave and that's it. No one hears about it. And we only hear about the cases that the family refused to leave.
What was it like working Palestinian and Israeli actors together, telling a true story?
Well, when we filmed the movie, when we accepted to be in this movie, we all accepted on what's in the script. So we went there, and everything was fine. Working with the actors, Israelis, but you know, the whole relationship was great until we start shooting, and then all the political problem, I think, started to pop up the surface.
How?
Well, it happened. It started happening when the actors refused to act as in the script. Like in the script, they were supposed to say, "Shut up, or I'll kill you."
This is the Israeli.
Yes,
military.
That's what in the script, and they said, "No, we want it. It's too violent for us. We don't want it this way," because they don't want the Israelis to be shown in a movie this way. And this is where the problem started. It's in the script.
How was it resolved?
Well, the director had to interfere and say, it's in the script and you approved to be in this movie and you read the script, so you had to do it. So this is where the problem started. They wanted all the violent scenes. They wanted to make it more kind and understanding.
Tell us about the family that you portray and who you portray in the film.
I'm the daughter in this family. The real family can be seen on a documentary that the director made. He first made the documentary and then decided to make the feature. And I
thought maybe audiences could accept it more if it was fictional. Dramatization,
yes.
As opposed to the documentary itself.
Exactly. And it's a good chance to see a Palestinian family on screen, because you don't get to see that. You just get to hear about us in, you know, some lines in the newspaper, and people don't get to see what Palestinian, how they look like, how they talk, how they, you know, they have feelings. They can cry and they smile and they can be nice.
Your father is Mohammed Bakri,
in
who
the
is
movie.
A famous actor.
Correct.
Most people wouldn't know him here.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think he's famous. His movie, last movie, was Janine Janine. It was on news all over the world, but...
What were you most surprised by in the making of this film?
I was surprised to have the political problems that usually us Palestinians living in Israel, we just try to ignore so that we can live together, because we live with the Israelis. And the political problems, they're always in the background, but we try to forget or ignore or not talk about it because they are our neighbors, and I have friends that are Israelis.
You grew up in Haifa?
Yes, in Haifa, and, yes. And I have friends that are Israelis, and my neighbors are Israelis. So we try not to talk about it. But when we went there to film this movie, it all came back, and we just had to deal with it because it's always there. And if we can't, I mean, it's a problem that has to be resolved. And if we can't do that, then it's gonna always be there.
Do you have hope?
Oh, well, I'm an actress, and I think actors always have hope and always believe in... I personally believe in kindness of people. I believe in peace and all the pink things and nice things. So I do have hope, I hope. But unfortunately, it's not happening.
Dean, as an Arab-American comic here in the United States, what is that like for you?
Well, interestingly, the media, the news media especially, has been very, very supportive, curious. We've become, in a way, and I even joke about it, but, you know, Arabs and Muslims have replaced the Soviet Union as the enemy of America. President Bush has talked about it clearly in recent speeches. Communism is replaced by radical Islam. Some people don't use the word radical. They just have it a war on Islam. So if you're Arab or Muslim, you're seen as the enemy. So there's a great deal of curiosity by the media, but yet still not embraced by the entertainment industry. Although I must say, for this festival, we've had the most entertainment industry come out to see us, casting people, agents, and managers. Because it's interesting what happened with Hand in her movie, where the Israeli actors wanted to change some of the script. Well, if we have more Arabs in movies as actors and behind the scenes as producers and directors and screenwriters, then we can have an impact. It's human dynamics. That's why we need more people in the entertainment field. So we're struggling. We're trying to get involved. And, you know, you're trying to show through our art that we have a culture. You know, there's Black History Month, there's Asian Awareness Month, Hispanic Awareness Month. We don't have that as Arabs. We get Orange Alert. You know, so we want to have more than that to define who we are. We don't want to be defined by simply terrorism or response to terrorism. We have a culture.
What was it like for you?
Dean Abdullah and Hend Ayoob of the Arab Film, the Arab Comedy Festival. It's playing through tomorrow night. That does it for today's broadcast. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.